Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And as you can hear, I'm perched on the Pacific Rim with a bit of a head cold out here in San Francisco, taking a look at the fault lines below and above ground here in the Bay Area. We're broadcasting from KQED San Francisco, one of the great community media institutions in America. We will think this hour about some very important developments on that Pacific Rim, including looking at the standoff between China and Vietnam over drilling rights in the oil-rich South China Sea. We'll also talk about the birth of a new TV star. Our good friend Jeff Yang, who's long followed the Asian-American experience for us on The Takeaway, took his son Hudson to an open audition for a new TV sitcom, and guess what? His son is the star of the new ABC show, Fresh Off the Boat, an Asian-American family's adventure fitting into America and standing out. Also, we'll talk about how the Supreme Court has stacked the deck against bankrupt consumers in the housing crisis. But we begin with a look at some controversial new approaches to the internet economy, federal regulations that could allow businesses to pay their way to a fast lane in high-speed broadband. Higher-speed broadband is at odds with the long-standing net neutrality regulations from the Federal Communications Commission. As of today, whether you're getting your content from YouTube, Netflix, or a much smaller company, it all moves at the same speed. But broadband and cable companies have been fighting the FCC to get their own fast lanes for years, and now the FCC has begun to take public comments on a new set of rules. The new rules would bar internet service providers or ISPs from slowing content. They'd have to keep the base speed the same, but there's a catch. Content providers could pay a premium for faster service. And with news of Comcast trying to acquire Time Warner Cable for $45 billion, making Comcast the dominant provider of cable TV and high-speed internet access, and AT&T announcing that it will try to buy DirecTV for $48.5 billion, a merger that makes AT&T second only to Comcast in the paid TV market, the big players are all getting bigger. What does it mean for startups who rely on a level playing field to have any chance to make it big themselves? Fresh off the plane yesterday, I spoke with the founders of two startups right here in the Bay Area. Martha Rotter is the developer and co-founder of Whoopi, a digital content creator, and she has just one other employee in her company. With her was Ryan Single, co-founder and CEO of Contextly, a link-sharing editorial app. Ryan has just three other co-workers. This latest net neutrality battle is part of a long war that began when former FCC Chairman Michael Powell called for a vast deregulation of the internet long before high-speed Wi-Fi and 4G phones even existed. Ryan Single says they had no model for what they were doing back then.
The FCC decided in the early 2000s to deregulate ISPs. And so essentially, you can think of it as like the Food and Drug Administration. They decided that these were foods and like they couldn't really make any rules about them. So now we have an industry that's really powerful and we're seeing a lot of consolidation. And so the ability of like a Comcast or an AT&T to start to extract money both from, you know, so their normal users and from, let's say, like a Google and a Netflix and then eventually all the app makers, they're in a really powerful position.
Is this the Powell legacy that we are seeing right now?
This is very much Michael Powell's legacy. So this was his decision and then his idea that they would just put in sort of nice rules that weren't actually rules. They were kind of principles and hoping that the industry would play nicely. And now we're getting to the point where we're seeing the industry not play nicely and start to say we're going to take advantage of the power that Michael Powell gave us when he was the FCC chairman.
If suddenly you're someone who has a great idea for an app or for a set of apps and you want to like arrive in the market, is there suddenly a set of obstacles for you?
It could be. It depends on the area that your app is in. So if you're a company like myself where we help publishers to distribute their magazines and publications and documents, then you have to then start thinking about, well, what does it actually cost for us and can we deliver this in a cost-effective way? So do we need to find a different way to distribute our assets like our video files and images and all of those types of things, which over the course of a lot of different customers for us, a lot of different publishers, that sort of adds up in terms of space, in terms of speed, in terms of money that you end up paying, and then also in terms of customers that you might lose because they don't have the patience to wait for that anymore, and they are going to go find somebody who did have the money to pay for the fast lane.
So basically, your customers are all of a sudden saying, hey, you know, you're a smart person, but do you have a deal with Comcast? Do you have a deal with Fox? Do you have a deal with whoever?
I think they're not saying that outright because they may or may not know. But what they do know is that when they sit in front of their browser, nobody has patience anymore. Performance is a premium and speed is a premium. And so people have choice today. They're not going to wait 10 minutes for your images to download. If you're in the slow lane, they're not going to, they might find somebody who has bigger pockets and can compete with that and can pay upfront to the Comcast or the AT&T for the faster speed.
So suddenly the product isn't the best idea or the smartest technology. It's the speed.
I think that's true. So over the last 10 years, it's been the opposite. So the price of broadband has gone down. The technology has gotten better. You know, servers are cheaper. So it's been really easy for small startups, guys and women that have great ideas, five people to start a company and compete with whoever's big, right? And compete with a Microsoft and now to compete with a Facebook or a Google or a Netflix. And what we're going to see now is that that actually flips around, that the incumbents are the ones that are going to be able to keep the sort of the innovation down by being able to pay their way to first place.
So are your bags packed for South Korea or wherever? Hmm?
I was actually very happy to see how quickly the sort of regular internet users and the Silicon Valley community really quickly like stepped up and said, this is not the proposal we want to see. These aren't the rules we want to see. And in fact, are pushing for rules that over the last 4 years have seemed like we were never going to get, which is essentially having the FCC treat ISPs as utilities, where they just have to be like a phone company and just deliver the information that you want with no preferences to anyone. And there's just been a lot. I mean, the FCC got overloaded with like tons of comments. We saw all the major internet companies, including ones who would benefit from this, you know, the Googles and Netflix, actually saying this is not what they wanted and signing the letters. So I'm pretty hopeful. I think we're going to, you know, this is going to, I used to cover this as a reporter for 6 years, and this is going to be another 6-year fight. This isn't going to be solved in the next like year. But I'm really happy to see the community and just regular users say this isn't what we want.
So suddenly the radical idea is the common carrier, the notion that came in with the railroads in the 1800s.
Well, now we're looking at internet service not as a luxury item, but as a utility, as something that everyone should have the right to access, whether it's in their home or whether it's at their library or on their phone. But everyone should be able to access the internet at a fair rate, at a fair speed.
Does Obama get that?
I think he does. I think there's been, you know, all of the blowback against this proposal, I think, is actually to the Obama administration's benefit. So they're really worried about the Fox Newses and the Republicans that are going to call this regulating the internet, which is what they said in 2010 and in 2008. Whatever they can do to make this not look like they are regulating the internet rather than just making there's like fair rules that are going to benefit consumers, benefit regular users, and benefit innovation, having the Googles and the Facebooks and then all the investors come on their side looks a lot better when your competition is, you know, AT&T and Comcast, who, you know, no one loves.
To both of you before we go, I mean, you know, the FCC came in with the radio waves, right? That's a technology you're probably familiar with. You know, what is that? That produces like live podcasts, right? That's what broadcast used to be. Exactly. So does the FCC have a clue here as to the rapidly changing iterations in technology?
I think they have a clue. I just think they don't feel like they have the political capital. I think Tom Wheeler would actually be very happy to have some sort of title too. The FCC wouldn't mind having that authority. Supreme Court's told them they can do it. It's just, can they get it through without Congress deciding to step in and rewrite the rules and overrule them? So this is, you know, a lot less about FCC understanding things. They're pretty savvy group of folks, and they have some, and Tom Wheeler has a pretty impressive staff. I think this is more of just a flat-out political fight.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that maybe they were a little bit surprised by the reaction to this very strong reaction on Thursday to that 3-2 vote. And so hopefully whatever pressure they're getting from the larger companies, that will be meted out by consumers reacting to that as well. So hopefully they are going to take people's feedback on board and start to take that into account when they're making their proposal.
So just to get me off the hook here, one way or another, depending on how this comes out, is there $100 million on the line for you?
We're a startup. We're really far away from being $100 million anything. So my guess is that they're going to start with the folks that have the most money. You know, either way this goes, it's not going to kill the startup ecosystem right away. This is just going to start. It's going to be a damper. And I think it would just be in long term, it would be bad for the American economy and for innovation and for just, you know, regular Americans.
We're also quite small at this point. So if it shuts down companies like me, hopefully it won't in the future for other organizations, or it won't stop them from getting started in the first place. And I think that that would be the scarier thing, that this becomes such an obstacle to people that they don't consider starting scrappy little companies who are going to challenge larger media organizations.
Well, thanks for coming out on a beautiful weekend here in San Francisco during the Bay to Breakers event and talking with us about this subject. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, John.
Thanks.
Martha Rotter is the developer and co-founder of Whoopi, a digital content creator. Ryan Singel is the co-founder and CEO of Contextly, a link-sharing editorial app.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The run for the Roses state is lined with gold, politically and literally. It's a Kentucky demolition derby in the race to unseat Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. He's facing a Tea Party challenger, Matt Bevin, in the primary, but McConnell is expected to handily win the GOP nod. But Democrats sense weakness and have put up Democrat Allison Lundergan Grimes. The three candidates have raised more than $32.4 million, with another $5 million coming in from outside sources. It's a real Citizens United Super PAC cash extravaganza.
Matt Bevin keeps making national headlines, but not in a good way. Bevin made the nightly TV comedy shows after he was caught making a speech to a cockfighting rally. Don't let the joke be on you.
I'm Mitch McConnell, candidate for the U.S. Senate, and I approve this message.
I'm Matt Bevin, and I approve this message.
What are fact checkers saying about mudslinging Mitch's latest attacks on conservative Matt Bevin? Misleading. Doesn't add up. Like Obama campaign attacks. After 30 years in Washington, voting for one bailout after another, slinging mud is all Senator McConnell has left.
But even with all that entertainment value and attracting more money than any other primary election, the state still expects only a 30% turnout. Dante Chinney is with us. He's the director of the American Communities Project at American University. And also with us is Philip Bailey, the political editor at public radio station WFPL in Louisville. Dante and Philip, welcome back.
Hey there.
So, Philip, a lot of entertainment value. Bevin's campaign has all kinds of flaws. How does this stack up? Tea Party, Republican incumbent, and the Democrat.
Well, if you look at, you know, the entirety of the Tea Party movement, 2010, the Tea Party was made up of everyone from libertarians to disaffected Democrats, and sort of took the establishment Republicans by surprise. 2014, I think Senator McConnell had plenty of time to think ahead. You saw him anticipate this, and I think that's why he handled it better than most establishment candidates did.
Where's the money coming from, Dante, and where is it going?
So what we did was we looked at just the candidates, contributions directly to the candidate, because I think what you get through that is an idea of what individual contributors are looking like, so support. And what we found was really interesting. McConnell obviously does very well in big cities and kind of urban suburbs, and he gets that money from all around the country. That's the advantage, really, of being a Senate Minority Leader. But the thing that was interesting in the numbers was that McConnell did very well in these evangelical hubs. And when you talk about the many parts that went into the Tea Party coalition, whatever you want to call it, in 2010, these evangelical communities were part of it. They were against the establishment Republicans. It was time to take a stand. We'll know a lot more when we see the results come in Tuesday night. But the fact that a greater percentage of McConnell's contributions came from the evangelical communities than they did for Bevin and with his contributions, that I think is significant. And it does show that some of those evangelicals in Kentucky, at least, came home to the kind of the establishment Republican Party. And I think that's going to be an aid. That's why one of the reasons why McConnell's going to win. But that also could be a big aid to him in the fall.
Thinking about the fall for a moment, does the profile of Mitch McConnell make this Democratic challenge a national race? And does that, is that reflected in national money coming into the Democrat?
It's national. Oh, yeah. Democrats would love to knock off Mitch McConnell. And yes, Grimes is bringing in a lot of money, and it's coming from all over. And, you know, she's got a lot of connections, actually, even on the West Coast, out in California. She's got a lot of money coming in from there. She had Martin O'Malley, for some reason, come speak in her state. That's a kind of an odd pairing, actually, when you look at kind of the conservative nature of Kentucky. And O'Malley, the governor of Maryland, is a fairly liberal guy. But there's no question that the national feeling in the Democratic Party, this is one they really would like to have. It's still, I think it's an uphill fight.
Cockfighting scandals notwithstanding, Philip Bailey, what we've found is that Tea Party voters tend to be pretty loyal. And with a turnout expected to be something on the order of 30%, is it possible that Bevin could pull enough from Mitch McConnell to reduce the turnout in the fall?
Well, that's his hope. I mean, a recent Bluegrass poll showed that about 39% of Matt Bevin supporters say they will vote for Mitch McConnell in the fall. 25% actually say they would vote for Alison Lundigan Grimes. Now, how a Tea Party person turns right around and votes for the Democrat in the fall election, that could be certain resentments at McConnell right now, given the attack ads back and forth. That could be representative just of the overall angst with McConnell that has really existed in Kentucky for really about 4 years. He's not very popular in this state at all, particularly among Tea Party folks. So that resentment could last. The real worry or concern for McConnell and his people isn't that those Tea Party folks will vote for Alison Lundigan Grimes, it's that they could stay home and sit on their votes by the time November turns around.
And so incumbency is really an issue for the Democrat. I mean, there's definitely a core of people who's dissatisfied with the incumbent, even though he's the minority leader.
Yeah, I mean, the recent poll that came out here in Kentucky showed that 62% of voters believe that if they could vote to throw out every member of Congress, they would. So there's an anti-incumbency overall. And Senator McConnell's approval numbers are really in the neighborhood of Barack Obama's, interestingly enough. As unpopular as the president is here in Kentucky, Senator McConnell is just as unpopular. There's the hope that that will change after the primary, but that's one of the reasons why national Democrats are swarming around this race. They smell the blood. They see the blood in the water with McConnell, and they would love nothing better than to knock off the leader of that party in much the same way Republicans did to Tom Daschle 10 years ago.
Dante Cheney, what would you say the fundraising strategies are here in Kentucky, and how will they be models for what happens in 2016?
Well, the thing that I think is interesting in the fundraising is when we looked at 2012, for instance, when Mitt Romney was out raising money, he was raising it from the same places Barack Obama was. So he was raising it from these big cities and these urban suburbs, the kind of big dense areas. That's what you see in McConnell's numbers right here. You know, for the Republican primary, because that's really what we're talking about in 2016, there were Rick Santorum, particularly Michelle Bachmann, very early on, was raising from these smaller areas. They were raising from these evangelical communities, these kind of rural communities. I think that what's going to be interesting to see is McConnell is probably almost certainly going to win Tuesday night by a very large margin. The question is, what does this fundraising makeup look like going forward? I mean, do some of these other places, I mean, do his numbers shoot up in the exurbs? My guess is he'll do better in those places. The thing I think to watch for from the fundraising perspective over the next like 4 or 5 months is, does he keep doing well in these evangelical communities, rural middle America, where he hasn't done very well yet, to be honest, and these evangelical communities, working class country, another kind of rural place. If he gets those numbers up and starts doing really, really well, what I think it's starting to show is maybe the Republican Party is putting the Tea Party behind it a little bit and coming together again. That would be very good for the party, obviously, going forward to 2016. But I do think the thing to keep in mind, presidential races are different. 2016, the whole feeling is going to be very different. Let's see where we are then.
Dante Cheney is director of the American Communities Project at American University in Washington, D.C. Philip Bailey is political editor at WFPL in Louisville, Kentucky. Philip and Dante, thanks so much.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A week ago, we reported on China unexpectedly moving a deepwater drilling rig into a disputed part of the South China Sea. Today, that has become a full-blown international confrontation between China and Vietnam. A series of protests in Vietnam last week escalated into anti-Chinese violence in several provinces. Several foreign-owned factories were set on fire at two industrial parks in Vietnam, and two Chinese workers were killed. Another 100 were injured. China has been sending ships to evacuate its workers from Vietnam. To help us understand the growing tension, we turn to Financial Times Asia editor David Pilling online from the Philippines. David, welcome.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me on.
How much are Chinese facilities in Southeast Asia a target here? How extensive are the holdings and assets in Vietnam?
Vietnam has become something of a manufacturing hub, partly because China's become more expensive to manufacture in. And so a lot of companies that were manufacturing in China have moved, including some Chinese companies themselves. One of the interesting things about these demonstrations is that they've actually been fairly indiscriminate. They started off attacking Chinese factories, but quickly spread to Taiwanese factories and even South Korean factories. Now, this may have been because of confusion, or it may have been because actually there was kind of pent-up frustration and that the demonstrations against China have been an excuse for other, to vent frustrations at other things.
What would you say is the, unseen tension here? Is there a sense of economic disparity, worker exploitation that has suddenly bubbled up here?
You know, whenever you have these big sort of factory complexes set up, you know, lots of men, you know, living alone in dormitories, there can be a sense of sort of isolation and exploitation. There is also considerable anger at China generally. I mean, this goes back very, very far. Vietnam was controlled by China for about 1,000 years, and the Vietnamese have not forgotten that. I think, funnily enough, there is also angst at the Vietnamese government itself. And funnily enough, when we saw anti-Japanese protests in China, some of those were directed at Japan, as the demonstrators said. But it's also a good excuse to vent your frustration against the government itself. And the Vietnamese governments and the Chinese governments are both authoritarian. They don't normally allow demonstrations. So if you have an excuse to demonstrate, to riot, sometimes these things can get out of hand.
Did the Chinese misread this situation, and how are they covering this? What are the official sort of explanations of what's going on in Beijing?
Well, there hasn't been huge coverage of it in the Chinese press. I think it's something of an embarrassment. I'm sure they have been taken by surprise. The official reaction is that the Vietnamese must clamp down on the demonstrators and restore order. Otherwise, they will, you know, lose their reputation as being a, you know, a good place to invest. But I suspect there's a lot more going on behind the scenes. And, you know, China has become more assertive in its claims in the South China Sea and the East China Sea, where it has a dispute with Japan. And China sees these claims as entirely justified, but there are many countries that see them as not entirely justified. And in the South China Sea, you know, it's not only Vietnam, it's Malaysia, it's the Philippines, where I am now. And they think that these islands, these stretches of sea, belong to them. The Chinese equally convinced that they belong to China. So I think China thought that it could kind of push this probably with impunity, because China is obviously stronger than any of these individual countries.
Any chance that Vietnam could do anything to move that drilling rig? Because that doesn't seem to be going anywhere.
I think that's impossible. I mean, Vietnam has a history of being, very strong in resisting. You know, obviously it beat the French, it beat the Americans, and it even beat the Chinese in a short war in the 70s. But, you know, this is not going to lead to war, at least not immediately. So what you have is a standoff. And in this standoff, I think, you know, China has the advantage because it is there.
Speaking to us from East Asia, David Pillings is Financial Times Asia editor. He's author of the book Bending Adversity, Japan and the Art of Survival. David, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, John.
Our retro report this week takes us back to the forensic labs of the 1970s and 80s. Fiber evidence, analysis of hairs and strands of fiber, played a key role in solving crimes.
Scientists say they can take one hair from a crime scene, isolate its DNA, and match it with a sample from a suspect.
At the FBI, in one of the nation's foremost forensic laboratories, they are running extensive tests, determining how the agency can take advantage of the new technology.
The use of hair and DNA analysis was presented as definitive, but deeper testing showed that in some cases, seemingly identical pieces of hair could come from different people. Suddenly, there was a crisis in the evidence room.
The hairs didn't come from the same individual. We started talking about, well, what did we see? Why did we think it didn't match? How good are we, in a sense? There's always that chance that you might be wrong. We never really knew what that chance was.
It was questionable hair evidence that convicted Kirk Odom, who served more than 20 years in prison for a crime he didn't commit.
I didn't get a chance to raise my daughter. She barely knows me. That really hurts.
The consequence of hair analysis in crime solving and the mistakes that can be made is the subject of this week's Retro Report. With us now, Scott Michaels, who produced that piece. Welcome, Scott.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
So how much was this a real, you know, fad is the wrong word, but at one point it seemed everything was based on fiber analysis.
Yeah, I mean, hair analysis was a very common type of evidence, probably one of the most common types of evidence. You know, if you think about how often hairs fall off your head, anytime there were violent crimes or sex crimes, it's very likely that hair evidence would be found at the crime scene. And microscopic analysis of hairs was something that was done really for more than 100 years. There are cases dating back to the 1800s.
But with the development of DNA evidence testing and, you know, sort of the ability to look down at the molecular level, suddenly it got presented as maybe more definitive than it turned out to be. How did that work?
Well, you know, the science behind microscopic hair analysis was always pretty limited, and it was never really strong enough to say definitively that a particular hair could come from a particular person with absolute certainty. And there were no population studies or statistics that would let you answer the question of how often two different people might have hairs that look exactly the same. And so really all that the examiners, the hair and fiber examiners, should have said when they testified in court was that two hairs were similar.
When the FBI looked back at cases that might have been improperly prosecuted on the basis of this evidence, what did they find?
Well, you know, they're still in the middle, actually, of doing a landmark review of several thousand cases from back from the 80s and 90s, from the days before DNA. And so we really actually don't know quite yet what they're going to find. They're going to have to go back and review the cases to see if the testimony was improper. And then lawyers, you know, prosecutors and defense attorneys are going to have to go back and sift through the evidence to see whether or not the hair evidence, you know, led to the conviction, and whether or not other people, innocent people, are in prison.
How crucial was that for Kirk Odom, the fiber evidence?
I mean, the hair evidence in his case was very important. I guess there are really two things that helped convict him. You know, the victim did identify him in a lineup, and then an FBI hair expert testified and basically linked the hairs that were found at the crime scene to Kirk Odom's hair. So they were very important in his case.
And how did he feel about this evidence pinning him for a crime that he never committed?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think for anyone who's wrongfully convicted of a crime, it's pretty devastating. But, I mean, he even told us that, you know, that he could see how the jury would have thought that he did it.
Finally, are defense attorneys more skillful at challenging this sort of evidence based on the history?
With advent of DNA, we've been forced to sort of confront the limitations of science, and I think defense attorneys and others have become more knowledgeable about the limitations of science. And now that we do have DNA testing, you know, the type of hair analysis that convicted Kirk Odom really is less of an issue because very frequently you can test the hairs for DNA.
Scott Michaels is a Retro Report producer on this week's report about the inconsistencies in hair analysis in crime labs. To see a video of Retro Report's findings, you can visit thetakeaway.org. Scott, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
If Wall Street didn't see the Great Recession coming in the last decade, consumers never had a chance.
What in the world is happening on Wall Street? Let's talk about the speed with which we are watching this market deteriorate.
We're red everywhere, essentially.
We're down over 16%.
We're now down 43%.
We're in the last days of this country surviving.
An economy boiling away in a worthless storm of risky paper and bizarre investment schemes. Investments supposedly insured with counterbets and hedges all crashed when everything declined in value at once. The financial meltdown of 2008 began and ended with home mortgages. But once the bankruptcies and foreclosures started to work their way through the system, consumers made a pretty nasty discovery. Unlike banks and financial institutions that were able to take advantage of generous restructuring deals and federal bailouts, consumers found they were locked into their mortgages. Jennifer Taub is a professor at Vermont Law School and author of the new book Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business. Taub tells the story of how, because of an obscure Supreme Court decision, Noblemans versus American Savings Bank, consumers discovered that they could not use bankruptcy to shield themselves from their own banks.
Leonard and Harriet Nobleman were a hardworking middle-class couple from Texas. In June of 1984, they bought for $71,000 a one-bedroom, one-and-a-half-bath condo. And for a while, things went well for them. But unfortunately, they faced personal and financial disaster shortly thereafter. And they were struggling to get by. At the same time, the condo had plummeted in value. As it happened, they bought that condo that June of 1984 at absolutely the wrong time. There was a tremendous housing bubble that had been facilitated by a fraudulent condo development scheme. What's interesting about that is that the savings and loan that was behind the condo development scheme was the very first thrift to fail in the SNL crisis, and it was shut down due to fraud.
Clearly, the fraudulent development was inflating the prices in Dallas, and the poor noblemen's, bought at the top of the market, which happens a lot. But it was what happened to their mortgage that really tells the story of how powerless they eventually became. Who originated their mortgage, and what happened to it that they didn't even know about?
Their mortgage was originated by one lender who then passed it on to another, but they kept making the mortgage payments to that first lender. The mortgage broker that originated their loan in June swiftly sold it to the largest SNL in the country. It was called American Savings and Loan. And ultimately, American Savings and Loan would, in 1988, just 4 years after they bought their condo, spectacularly crash. It had to be bailed out by the government, and it was rescued by a new entity with new owners called American Savings Bank. And that rescue was very expensive. It cost the government about $5.2 billion. So you have these two different stories happening at the same time. You have these homeowners who are the indirect victims of this condo fraud scheme that drove up prices. And then you have this savings and loan that failed due to a lot of corruption and fraud.
And the interesting thing here is that you've got two institutions. You've got the homeowner in this case, regular citizens of America, and the banks doing what is typically done in a situation where a bubble bursts. You've got the banks trying to make deals to survive, and they get a lot of money from the federal government to get bailed out and become American Savings Bank. And you've got the noblemen's who try to deal with their financial difficulties and hire a lawyer and try to make their own deal, right? And what we learn in your book is that it's a rigged game and that the noblemen's were in a much weaker position than they ever thought. And that's what the issue that went to the Supreme Court.
That's right. They were trying to go into the bankruptcy court and say, we still owe about $65,000 on this loan, but our condo is only worth $23,500. So we'll pay that $23,500, but we're going to pay it monthly over 5 years. What they found out was that they were too small to save.
Well, the bank said, no, you pay full price, and went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was basically the Fifth Circuit, which decided that, no, the banks needed to get full price, that mortgage owners aren't protected under bankruptcy laws. And that was what was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court and the judgment handed down by Clarence Thomas, who wrote the unanimous opinion.
Yes, the court decided not to protect homeowners. And they did this because there was this other provision of the bankruptcy code that was put in by industry lobbyists to try to give special protection to mortgage lenders.
So what did this mean for consumers heading into 2008? They really didn't have any protection here.
Consumers today are still struggling, just like the noblemen's, with underwater mortgages. There are about 9 million homeowners who are severely underwater on their mortgages. And this is something that was recognized by some progressive members of Congress. The House of Representatives passed a bill to fix this problem in the bankruptcy code. However, when it came up in the Senate in April of 2009, it failed to pass.
So what kinds of vulnerabilities do we see in the housing market today? Really, you've got a system here that was set up to give banks lots of recourse and homeowners almost no recourse.
I think it creates a kind of moral hazard on the part of lenders. And I think this began way back when the Nobleman decision came down. It encouraged lenders to make unwise loans, especially those loans with very little money put down. But then when there is a bubble and it bursts, it creates a tremendous disparity between banks who are more politically connected versus those ordinary homeowners who don't have as much of a voice, who've been let fail.
You describe in your title that mortgages are a thrilling business because of all these crazy risks and strange products that developed since the 1980s, including the adjustable rate mortgages and that sort of thing. Would you say it's a thrilling business or a scam?
I think that there are some really honest bankers, but I would say that there was a time when the incentives were such that pumping out volume was more important than considering whether borrowers had the ability to pay back their loans. There was not a concern, and there was a lack of concern and sometimes disdain for the ability for people to hold on to their homes.
Jennifer Taub is the author of Other People's Houses, How Decades of Bailouts, Captive Regulators, and Toxic Bankers Made Home Mortgages a Thrilling Business. She's a professor at Vermont Law School. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's the classic American tale of growing up with the manicured lawns and the cars in the driveway and the beaver's perfectly crooked baseball cap. Leave It to Beaver begat All in the Family, begat The Cosby Show, begat Married with Children. The Beaver days of sitcoms are long gone in America. Today, that show would seem more like a space alien episode of Outer Limits, another show long gone. But here's some reality that apparently is ready for primetime.
Why do all your shirts have black men on them?
It's Notorious B.I.G.
You in a B.I.G.?
Yeah, man.
Come sit with us.
Oh, what is this?
It's Chinese food.
Get it out of here.
Ying Ming's eating worms.
I need white people lunch.
ABC's new show, Fresh Off the Boat. It's the story of a Taiwanese family moving from Chinatown in Washington, D.C. to open up a steak restaurant in Orlando, Florida. It's loosely based off of celebrity chef Eddie Wong's memoir. The star of Fresh Off the Boat, Hudson Yang. He plays a young Eddie Wong, a preteen who has to front for his embarrassingly traditional family. Eddie is always having to choose between the cool hip-hop world around him, the white people food at McDonald's, and his Asian roots. Also with us is Hudson's dad, Jeff Yang, a columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome, guys.
Well, thank you.
Hi.
Jeff Yang, you're definitely a student of the Asian American experience. Does this show seem to get things right?
This show is actually remarkably authentic. I think, in particular, the scene that involves Eddie bringing for the first time his homemade Chinese food lunch to a lunchroom full of suburban white kids who react less than charitably, shall we say, to the look and smell of it. That's something which actually I remember personally growing up and encountering. And even that phrase, I need white people lunch, I think I actually said that at one point.
What is white people lunch? I guess bologna sandwich, hamburger, pizza.
It's Lunchables.
Lunchables. So great.
Back in the day, yeah, it was anything that could fit into a small box and was covered with plastic. That was white people lunch.
And what did your parents think of Lunchables, Jeff?
They had trouble even comprehending why people would want to eat something like that. I mean, it didn't look much more appealing than the packaging it came in, and yet there's something about that sort of standardization and uniformity. It's almost like assimilation in a box, basically.
You know, a lot of this show is about how kids can be a little, maybe Hudson, embarrassed by their immigrant parents who don't get the world that they see. Your dad's pretty cool, though, huh?
Yeah.
So this isn't an experience that you've necessarily had. Your dad, I mean, he's pretty embarrassing. Let's be real. But I mean, he sort of gets America and the world around you, right?
Well, I can understand that because he was born here, and he's always been doing a lot of American things, and well, he's never really been too embarrassing when I'm near my friends. So I guess he's
pretty cool.
You know, Jeff, the stories here are very, very funny, and in many ways they don't reflect the really dark history of Asian American immigration, where, you know, in the 1800s, Chinese were not permitted to come with families to the United States. The sense of segregation that existed in the early part of the 20th century. It's a very different experience in this generation. Can you describe the sort of long arc of Asian American immigration?
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, my own parents came in 1965, and that was the first time that Asians were allowed in essentially large numbers into the United States. Prior to that, there were laws restricting the percentage of immigrants who could come from countries in Asia. And prior to 1965, as a result, if you were Asian in America, you were a second-class citizen. Even through the 60s, obviously, you know, through the civil rights era up until the 80s, 90s, and so forth, Asian Americans were such a tiny fraction, such a small minority of the U.S. population, that this notion of being constantly an alien presence, of eternal foreigners, was something that Asian Americans had to deal with on an almost regular basis. And again, growing up myself in the 80s and the 90s, you still had that palpable sense of being presented as different all the time, being asked, what language did you grow up speaking? Where is that from, that food you're eating? That was something that I grew up with. And I do think that what's interesting is Hudson and his generation is really growing up in a world in which the things that made us different and exotic and weird are kind of making them sort of cool and interesting instead.
Hudson, are you aware of that? Is it cool to be Chinese today?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of Asian American kids now in my school, and it's really cool to be me. I mean,
it is cool to be you.
It's not like I would want to be anybody else.
Is it like a real family, the people in the show?
Yeah, they're really nice to me, and they care about a lot about each other. So they're like my second family.
And is there something to write about to this experience for you, Jeff?
I think that we are in an incredibly interesting period of time for media in general and television in particular. I think we're looking at an era in which even just this season, there's more diversity and a greater range of perspectives and faces and voices being represented that look like America than ever before. And for me, obviously, as a writer, it's a little odd, a little through the looking glass to be on the other side of that lens and watching it happen from the inside. But I'm getting a pretty good sense that this year is going to be very interesting, and it's great to have that ringside seat.
In the 94, Margaret Cho's show was a sort of flash in the pan. Do you think this has more of a chance to survive?
Well, when you think about it, back in 1994, there was just around 3% of the U.S. population, a little over 3%, like around 8 million Asian Americans in the United States. And today we're approaching 18 million. That alone, the size of the population and the degree to which we've really, in many ways, emerged as a community, changes the way the show is going to be received. But it also changes the way in which the show is talking. I mean, one thing which is really interesting to me is that this is a show that's set essentially in the era in which All American Girl was coming out. Margaret Cho's show came out in 1994. This show set around 94, 95. And you can almost feel how much of a period piece it is when you're watching the show. You realize how different we live today from a world in which people would go, ew, what is that, to a bowl of noodles or something. I think that where this show is, it's giving for the first time Asian Americans a chance to be able to laugh with ourselves and not just at ourselves. And that alone, I think, is kind of revolutionary.
Jeff Yang is the father of Hudson Yang, who's the star of the new ABC series Fresh Off the Boat. Congratulations, guys, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you're having a conversation about diversity on network television. Here's a tweet from Orla who says, always portraying white Western males in power. One would assume they do a good job and are natural leaders. Wrong on two counts. We'd love to know what you think. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. More of this conversation on our Facebook page. Special thanks to all our good friends at KQED San Francisco for looking after us. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Reputation.com, encouraging everyone to check their online search results because search results define you or your business. Learn more at Reputation.com. TiVo, able to search cable TV, on-demand libraries, and streaming content from Netflix and Hulu Plus on a single screen. Available at TiVo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.